The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. For most modern pet owners, dogs represent companionship, loyalty, and love. But throughout history, man's best friend has also been associated with our conceptions of death. You've probably seen images of Anubis, the jackal-headed Egyptian god of embalming and funerals, or heard of Cerberus, the three-headed hound that guarded the gates of hell in Greek mythology. Fast forward to today, where cadaver dogs are specially trained to locate human remains. Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science, journalism, and creative nonfiction. She's also a cadaver dog handler, and her new book is called What the Dog Knows. And Kat, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Taylor. It's really delightful.
Of course. So I mentioned Anubis in the introduction, but we were really stunned to find that dogs weren't just symbols. You write that the Zoroastrians actually used dogs in their funerary rites. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Zoroastrians are a kind of interesting case because very early on, they integrated dogs into almost every aspect of their lives. And so, you know, they had the herding dogs. They had something called house dogs, which were kind of the equivalent of our lap dogs. And then they had these dogs called Sogdid. And what the Sogdid dog did was that it drove away the demons that might otherwise inhabit people's bodies, and which was a great fear. And what the Zoroastrians realized is that dogs could be around dead bodies and even, let's say, eat dead bodies without these demon gods coming after them. And so there was that kind of like, well, let's take advantage of this. And so they created these dogs that were specifically brought in to stand by the corpse and gaze on it and drive away the demons that might otherwise inhabit that loved one.
Were these special breeds of dogs? Were they specific colors? What set them apart?
An archaeologist sent me a beautiful little bronze figurine of what they thought a Sogdid dog was, and it looked exactly like a German Shepherd, which pleased me utterly because, since I have two of them. But one of the things that they had to be was reasonably young male, and then that they would have quote-unquote four eyes. And what they meant by that is that these are the dogs that had little color patches above their eyes.
Oh, like little spots.
Little spots. And, you know, many of the herding breeds are, if you think about shepherds or even Rottweilers or other kinds of dogs, you know that those two-tone dogs are very often either in working or herding breeds. And those were the rules for these dogs that would come in and essentially protect corpses.
What is it about guarding the dead that people associate with a dog? Why a dog and why not some other type of animal?
Well, you know, it's so interesting to go back to the history of the dog, but we do know that early on, dogs were used to help dispose of bodies because dogs would eat people. And so when you had early civilizations and you would put the dead outside the gates of a city, for instance, the dogs would help take care of that. And it's that notion that if dogs can do this and not suffer from it, then they must have special powers. You know,
you mean because so many other animals, or because humans, of course, would get terribly sick. And yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, humans had so much fear around death, and to see the kind of impunity with which dogs enjoyed themselves around corpses. It was like, let's turn what could be considered a negative into a positive.
Well, you did mention that you have two German shepherds. Is that right?
I do.
Two German shepherds. And I know from the book that one of them is a cadaver dog. But I guess I was surprised to find that you sort of fell into being a cadaver dog handler. It's not something that you necessarily planned on. Can you talk a little bit about what led you to train your German shepherd to become a cadaver dog?
Yeah, because as one trainer said, he was a jackass. We had this
a technical term, we had a
German shepherd pup, and I was expecting, my husband had fallen in love with shepherds, and we were expecting a pretty quiet, low-key, obedient, loyal dog. And Solo was several of those things, but he was also really a little hellion. He was a singleton, which meant that he had been the only pup in his litter. Mm-hmm. And that meant that he was essentially emotionally stunted around other dogs. He could not sort of read their language. And that's the way dogs get in trouble. So a lot of singletons happen to be dog aggressive. And Solo was, as a pup. We were just at the end of our ropes. And I took him to a trainer whom I respected greatly. And it was she who said, why don't you make him into a cadaver dog? And so that's what happened. By the time he was two, I started training, was invited to train with a local police canine unit by their sergeant, with whom I still train today. And
let's talk a little bit about the work and about the training. I mean, how does one train a cadaver dog, especially, I sort of think about what you said earlier, how does one prevent it from eating what it discovers? I mean, that's morbid.
Well,
but
you know, it's morbid, but it's realistic. I mean, let's face it, humans are mammals, and we all know the delight with which some dogs go out in the woods and find a dead deer or a dead squirrel.
Sure, and we wouldn't we wouldn't be surprised if
shocked. I mean, we might be a little repulsed from the smell whatever, but it's sort of like, yeah. And so you train them essentially by distracting them. If there are dogs that have a tendency to say, oh gosh, this smells good, Solo is not one of those dogs, but what you're immediately doing is getting them more interested in their toy, or even for some dogs, a liver treat, and that sense of I really want to consume this goes away very fast.
So what else goes into the training of a cadaver dog?
So one of the things that you have to do early on is teach the dog what that scent is. And what's interesting about cadaver scent is we still don't know a lot about it. We know that it's one of the most complex scents other than live human scent. Arpad Voss, who's a forensic anthropologist, has identified 480 different volatile compounds coming off of decomposing human bodies. That's a lot.
Kind of
I know. He thinks that once his DOA, which stands for Decomposition Odor Analysis Database, is done, he thinks it'll be closer to 1,000 compounds. And so what you're doing is you're telling the dog that all of these different scents and various combinations of them all are the thing they're looking for.
I'm speaking with Kat Warren. She's a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism and creative nonfiction. Her new book is What the Dog Knows, and she's also a cadaver dog handler. Her dog Solo just retired after 9 years as a cadaver dog. Now, do cadaver dogs need to have like especially good noses? I mean, are they known for being able to sniff out anything?
Lots of dogs have very good noses, and cadaver dogs have very good noses. It's not really relevant what the breed is. What you want is a dog that wants to work, has the ability to sort of ignore lots of distractions. Some of that happens in training. And then just like you can train a drug dog to find different kinds of narcotics, you can train a cadaver dog to find different stages that humans can go through as they decompose. So as you can well imagine, you might have somebody who is very recently missing, up to really ancient bones. We have evidence that dogs have been very good at helping locate bones from the old Mississippi Delta civilizations, the Mound people.
But I typically think of bloodhounds as being a dog that's really used to sniff out. You know, it's I guess maybe it's a movie trope, but you know, you show them a piece of fabric and they can trace anything and anybody to any location. But it doesn't seem like bloodhounds would be the go-to cadaver dog.
Well, the process is a little different. With a tracking or trailing dog, it's that classic trope, as you said, where you show them something to sniff that belonged to that person and then tell them to go find that person, and they're following the trail of that person. With cadaver dogs or with drug dogs, what those dogs are doing is they're trying to find in the air a scent. So they're basically quartering back and forth to find that scent. And you'll also see that if you see dogs working on a disaster scene, right, they're not following a trail. They're going up on that rubble and they're trying to find a hint of live human and in some cases dead human. And so they're simply going around these rubble piles looking for that scent, because there's nothing to track. So once they hit that scent, what they're going to do is they're going to go down to where that scent is most concentrated. And ideally, you'll have a live victim who can be saved by that.
Right.
Sadly, in some cases, it also helps find somebody who's deceased.
You know, I think it would be obvious to anybody that a human being working in those sorts of conditions is going to be liable to feel some trauma, you know, that there can be some real emotional distress associated with that kind of rescue operation. Do you know at all if dogs, if rescue dogs or cadaver dogs, feel the sort of weight of those situations?
So it's a complicated answer. Mm. In principle, no, because if you have a cadaver dog, you are training them to feel utter joy when they find the dead, because they're going to get the reward that they're waiting
right,
for.
The toy, right? Or the treat, yeah.
That, exactly. So a well-trained dog does not say, oh my God, I've just found somebody dead. This is so upsetting. That said, if you have a dog that we call a live find dog and it's put into a situation, and this certainly happened in 9/11, where they're not finding live victims, it can be upsetting for the handler and for the dog. So some of the discussion that came about saying that the dogs got depressed when they found somebody who was dead, it wasn't so much that. It was that dogs were being used in situations where it just wasn't in their training to be finding what they found.
You know, we think of these dogs that do work, whether it's finding cadavers or other types of service. You know, we think about it a lot of times in terms of the benefit that it provides to us. But I wonder, you know, does it provide a benefit to the dog? Did Solo really benefit from his life as a cadaver dog?
You know, I could ask him, and I don't know what he would say.
He's not there in the studio with you, is he?
You know, he's not in the studio. He loved training. He loved going on searches. And I think that several things happened. First of all, it opened up a world to him that might have been more narrow given his issues with other dogs if I hadn't discovered this work. But it gave him enormous freedom and a lot of area to stretch his legs and his brain, right? The other thing it did is that there's some evidence that working dogs actually have longer and healthier lives. There's some early research that people are starting to do, like Cindy Otto down up at Penn, about the fact that working dogs are pretty happy dogs. They're very physically fit. They are, for the most part, not obese. And they get out a lot, and they get to think and work. And for many dogs, that's a pretty happy thing.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really, really fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate being invited.
Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches science journalism and creative nonfiction. Her book, What the Dog Knows, is now out in paperback, and you can find a link to more information at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we move from corpse-sniffing dogs to mountain-climbing pups. Up next, we'll hear from a blind hiker who summited all of New Hampshire's 4,000-footers with the help of a guide dog. And that story's coming up after a break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. More than 1 million Americans are legally blind, and when they hike and run, most prefer to pair up with a human guide, which, unlike guide dogs, can give instructions verbally and explain obstacles at a quick pace. A handful of blind runners and hikers do prefer to work with dogs, though, and Ariel Zients brings us this story.
Watch the tree, right? Watch the tree. I know you're all fired up. She's so excited about snow. She's not doing her job real well right now. Autumn, heel. I need your focus. Ready? Work.
That's Randy ready? Pierce talking to his new guide dog, forward. Autumn. They're getting ready to hike to the summit of Pac Monadnock, a mountain in southern New Hampshire. This was only Autumn's fifth hike and her first in the snow. Autumn is Randy's third guide dog. He's had her for 8 months, and it will take about a year for the pair to be totally in sync with each other.
To go from a guide dog, you worked 8 years together. You know everything that you want to do together. You know how to communicate, and you just are smooth and fluid together. To a new dog who doesn't know any of your habits, listens differently, has different motivations, and you have to learn to understand them and build that relationship over again. It's a lot of work to get back to where you were before.
Here's how a guide dog team works. Autumn wears a harness and walks to Randy's left. She guides him around obstacles like trees, signs, and potholes. But sometimes there are obstacles that you can't just walk around. If Autumn comes across a big step, road, or river crossing, she stops. It is then up to Randy to figure out what he is facing and how to get around it. The more they hike together, the better Autumn will become at judging and communicating the presence of an obstacle. They will eventually be able to hike faster, and Randy won't trip or hit obstacles as often. Randy hasn't always had to hike with a guide dog. He was born sighted, but lost most of his vision when he was 22. It happened over a period of 2 weeks. His optic nerves deteriorated. He was left with narrow tunnel vision in one eye and became totally blind in the other.
I didn't know anything about blindness, really, at that point, but you begin to learn. First off, I learned that I'm not going to be able to drive that brand new car I just bought.
11 years later, Randy was riding the bus with Austin, his first guide dog. The dog placed his head on Randy's lap, and using the narrow tunnel vision in his left eye, Randy looked down at Austin.
And I saw this beautiful face looking up at me with love, adoration, concern, and then it closed out. And that's the last thing I ever saw.
At that moment, Randy became completely blind.
Think about how wonderful. If you've got to have a last image, you know, I could have been watching a commercial, but I was looking at a loving face, and that's what I get to keep with me forever.
In 2005, Austin passed away from a tumor in his heart. Randy was then matched with a new guide dog, the Mighty Quinn.
I walked so much and got so good at all the basics, and Quinn loved the woods so much, I said, you know what? I wonder how he'd handle going back out, because I wanted to try a mountain. Because mountains are synonymous with challenge, and I love that notion.
Dogs are better than human guides at maneuvering through tight trails, and when it comes to snow and ice, they are often the safer choice. Dogs tend to slip less, which means Randy won't go down with them. But most importantly, dogs give Randy a greater sense of independence.
You get this feeling of pride and personal accomplishment when you do it together as a guide dog team and handler. When I add another person in, well, I'm proud of what they and I are doing together, but it takes a little bit away from my feeling of my self-accomplishment. And while we're dependent on the dog, you build so much of a bond that you're sort of a little bit of one and the same.
Randy's greatest hiking accomplishment so far is summiting New Hampshire's 48 peaks over 4,000 feet in a single winter season. Soon after helping Randy achieve that goal, Quinn was diagnosed with bone cancer. And in January 2014, Randy said goodbye to a guide dog for the second time.
When he was playing, he didn't feel the pain. And we must have played all morning as much as he could before heading into the vets to say goodbye to him. And then my wife and I both, we cradled him in our arms. And I told him how proud I was of him. How lucky I was to have such an amazing boy. Both whispered our love to him. We held him while he took his last big heavy sigh of breath.
Quinn was well known around New Hampshire. The media covered the team's accomplishments, and Randy regularly speaks at schools. So when Quinn passed away, a whole community grieved. Hundreds of people sent condolences through the mail and commented in online obituaries. Some people even made fan art. A favorite is a photoshopped image. With his white wings, the mighty Quinn is leaping towards heaven from a snowy mountain summit. I asked Randy if his feelings of independence and accomplishment are worth the difficulty of the cycle he goes through, training and bonding with the dog, working together, saying goodbye, getting a new dog, repeat.
All the pain and the grief and the loss and the anger sometimes during that, that's horrible. But over time, you learn it's more about the choice to celebrate all of the wonderful experiences you had, and all of those experiences that are possible are well worth every bit of that pain. It won't lessen that pain any.
Randy's new dog, Autumn, is not as accurate and fast as the mighty Quinn, at least not yet. With Quinn, Randy could hike Pat Monadnock in 30 minutes, but with Autumn, it took him around an hour.
In the start of our hike, it showed that she was more distracted. I had to build my trust, and I had to kind of hold her back and teach her a little bit. And about halfway up, she really hit a nice stride, and we were going well. And then as we got near the top, she got a little tired.
Randy is confident Autumn will improve. And next fall, he plans to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Randy will be using human guides for those adventures, but will have to train. And for that, Autumn will be by his side. For Salt Radio, I'm Arielle Zients.
And we move from canines to another hairy beast, man. A look into the surprisingly controversial world of men's back hair removal when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Normally, we introduce our topics with a little exposition and context, but I'm going to cut right to the chase and tell you this next interview is straight up about back hair. Did that make you cringe? Well, you may be part of the problem. New York Magazine's Kat Steffel recently dove into the wild world of men's back hair removal and discovered it's far more common than you might expect and far more controversial than other types of hair removal. And a bit of warning, there are many types of hair removal, and we'll probably be talking about a few of them in the next few minutes. Kat Steffel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Thanks for joining us. So I'm going to start off with a little admission that my upper torso is pretty much naturally hairless. So this subject is totally new to me. Were you as surprised as I was to discover how big back hair removal has gotten?
Totally. You're blessed, first of all.
Thank you. I know it.
Because when you see shirtless guys in movies or, you know, advertisements for Abercrombie and Fitch, they're totally hairless. I just assumed that most men were naturally back hairless. But recent essays by some writers for Slate and the columnist Andrew Sullivan revealed that guys have been quietly waxing and narrowing and shaving each other, just like women.
It seems strange to me because, you know, as opposed to hair removal for women, which is something, you know, gets talked about a lot, we sort of all know that it happens, but this back hair phenomenon is, it's like a weird secret.
Yeah, there's definitely still some grooming stigma for a lot of men. I write mostly about women's issues, and pubic hair removal is like a perennial hot topic. Anytime you mention it, there's a comment section, you know, hundreds of people deep talking about what it means to remove or not remove your pubic hair. So it was sort of shocking to see this silence surrounding the male equivalent.
I guess the idea here is that the same sort of controversy over the removal of pubic hair, that has become a central conversation topic for back hair. Is that pretty much the gist?
Basically, I would say that it's they're not quite equivalent yet, because as pubic hair removal has become both like more mainstream and more debated, women's magazines and women's media sort of represent an array of options and say, you know, you do you. It's, there's like a feminist element to the conversation.
Yeah.
But back hair is still pretty, there's still like really strict rules surrounding it. GQ said back hair is never sexy, which is just something a women's magazine could never get away with saying about, even about leg hair or armpit hair. You know,
that's
true. You can't really say that about women's body hair because it's been politicized, but not so with back hair. Yet, I think that's changing. There's been some sort of recent discourse about it by gay writers who are trying to reclaim it.
Reclaim it how?
Mark Joseph Stern at Slate wrote that he not only is going to bare his own back hair in tank tops, which he was previously too ashamed to wear, but also he encouraged other gay men not to tease other men, gay or straight, for their back hair.
You also write that Seth Rogen is like a hero of the back hair movement, the pro back hair movement.
Right. One of my colleagues at Vulture.com observed that Seth Rogen had stopped waxing his back hair sometime in between Knocked Up and Neighbors.
That's so, and I want to go back and watch Knocked Up just to see his waxed back. I didn't even realize.
No, me neither. I mean, what my colleague at Vulture, Jesse David Fox, noticed that was so funny was that Seth Rogen would be covered in fur just until, you know, the halfway point, and then suddenly it all disappeared on his back, which in retrospect looks totally crazy, and I don't know why no one noticed.
So do you think it's men's magazines and movies primarily that seem to be driving the standard for a hairless male back?
Definitely. I don't know where else people would be getting the message, because in reality, if you go to the beach, a lot of guys have back hair.
Yeah. I think it's very funny that this trend would be happening concurrently with the pro giant beard trend. You know, I mean, we've got giant beards, but I can imagine that a lot of the same sort of giant Brooklynite beards that you might see might be on hairy men who are waxing their backs, which just seems like a contradiction to me.
That's totally true. And there's a parallel thing happening with women and body hair. I know women who, you know, don't shave their armpits, but do shave their legs. Or my colleague at The Cut, Maureen O'Connor, wrote about something called the full bush Brazilian, which is women removing a lot of their pubic hair, but also leaving enough to still show that they're adult women and they have it. So people are definitely embracing hairiness in sort of measured ways.
I guess do you think this just goes to show you that, you know, you really are making a statement however you wear your hair, wherever that hair is, no matter what. Like, there is no such thing as non-political hair.
I tend to think so. I mean, I guess unless you go totally, totally ungroomed. But no, even then, it's always, yeah, you're always saying something. But I think what's interesting is that no matter what you say, someone will be into it.
Any examples? Like, Burt Reynolds' back hair, that was probably sexy back hair.
Yep, definitely. Who else? Roger Moore had back hair.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Kat Steffel, thank you so much for taking on this very bizarre topic with me. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Bye.
Bye. Kat Steffel wrote the article, Back Hair Surpasses Pubic Hair as Most Political Hair, for New York Magazine. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm bringing sexy back. Special, what's behind your back? Yeah. So turn around and I'll pick up the slack. Okay, so we move now from back hair to backtracking. That's a little analyzed phenomenon that's become standard in the live music industry, and it's one that occasionally grates on producer Alex Kappelman, who, along with Whitney Jones, examined backtracking in this episode of their music podcast, Pitch.
So, Alex, set the scene for me here.
All right, so it's a beautiful night in Austin, Texas, in 2013. It's South by Southwest, and I'm seeing one of my favorite bands, Vampire Weekend. There's four of them on stage, and they're rocking out, and all of a sudden I hear this kind of fifth part, and I'm thinking, oh, is one of them playing some new crazy instrument that I can't really hear? Like, where is this part coming from? There's only four of them and there's five parts. All of a sudden, this disappointment and anger and just welling of emotions just flows up in my body, because I realize that they're playing to a backing track.
Pitch is our perception of frequency.
Pitch is how that note sounds when you hear.
Pitch is...
All right, so when I say backing track, here's what I mean. It's pre-recorded music that's being played underneath other live instrumentation. So, for example, in the live band that we were about to start...
We have been talking about, yes.
What was the name of that band, Whitney?
Moses and His Tabernacle Choir.
So when we start the Moses and His Tabernacle Choir band, I mean, I'm clearly going to be on drums. And what instrument were we going to play again?
Guitar.
Guitar, right. So we'd need to fill out the sound a little bit, right? We'd maybe want a bass, maybe a guitar. We're not talking like Milli Vanilli over here, where like we get you know, two random people to record our parts, and then we totally lip sync it underneath. We're talking about something that supplements our live instrumentation. All right, so let me play you an example of what this sounds like in practice. This is a track called Take the City by Avant Lavoie. They're an electropop band. There's a drummer, there's a keyboardist, and they have three singers. So this is what they all sound like, just the five of them playing live.
Little bit crazy, little bit high, anything goes tonight, yeah, ooh, we could take this city, yeah.
And here's the backing track that they play underneath that. So when you're in the audience, here's what you're actually going to hear. All right, so that's both of them together, and that is definitely a lot fatter. You know, but still, I come from like this tradition of like jam bands and classic rock bands, and you know, you worship guys like Jerry Garcia and Jimi Hendrix for being just phenomenal musicians. And I think, you know, if a band is good, they're good. You don't need a computer. The band Haim. They're blowing up right now. They're one of my favorite bands too. They put on an amazing live show because it's just the three ladies and their drummer. No backing track, and they absolutely rock it. I still like the Vampire Weekend concert. They were really great performers. It was a great show. But the fact that they played with a backing track just like really, really bothered me. So I decided to find out why. And when I started learning about this stuff, I was mortified. It's not just Vampire Weekend. It's lots of other bands too.
I mean, I think it's totally an industry standard at this point. I mean, it's totally accepted. Now, especially now that it's made it in... It's really made its way in the indie world.
That's Ian Pei. Ian plays drums in Avant Lavoie, that band we just played. And he also creates the band's backing tracks. He's been making backing tracks for years now for acts like Blue Man Group, Fisher Spooner, and Cat Power. And he told me that pretty much everyone out there is playing to a track. Can you list some examples that you know for sure are doing it?
Well, Kanye, you know, Jay-Z. Pretty sure... Yeah, Justin Timberlake, Madonna, you know. I mean, it's everywhere. It's on every rung of the ladder. I mean, you go to a smaller town or city, and if there's a guy in a bar playing with a guitar, a lot of times they have backing tracks. I mean, maybe it's not in the form of a computer. Maybe it's a sequencer, but it's the same thing.
Bands have been able to do this for a while, but it was expensive. And it wasn't until recently that this stuff became widely available.
I think that maybe 7-8 years ago, I first started seeing it show up in indie bands on tour and in festivals. And it was kind of a nightmare because the technology wasn't quite there. People didn't know how to put it together. Like, you know, we learned by screwing up a lot. Like I had screensavers and like, you know, my computer would go to sleep after a certain amount of time. And I forget about this stuff in the beginning, and so we're playing in front of 50,000 people. My computer's plugged in not only to the sound system, but also to the video screen. And just like this giant beep goes off, and then my photo library is playing on a video screen in front of 50,000 people. And then you hear the audience kind of react to it. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then I look back, and there's like pictures of the band like on the beach in Ibiza.
I would have flipped out if I were at that show. A human being would never stop playing in the middle of a set to show photos of his entire family. But humans definitely have disadvantages too. They need to eat, they need to pay their bills, and that all costs money, which bands aren't necessarily going to be able to afford. So when backing tracks became more available, they started to replace humans.
I think it's, I think a lot of it's economics and practicality. I think that the way people are recording music now is much more complex. They're layering a lot of different sounds, and without those sounds, the song changes. And sometimes the songs are dependent on these all these layers. So they have to have these sounds to recreate it, but they can't have like 10 keyboard players.
We have this idea of the way that things should be, and then we know the way that things are.
That's Jennifer Lena. She's a sociology professor at Columbia who studies music.
And we often ask or expect that the bands that we care about, the acts that we care about, the art that we care about, do better than the way things are and try to approach the way things should be. But I think every time we blame individual performers for acting rational within the system that we have, we're kind of missing the structural point.
But that's, you could argue that, like, if you play live and you play with a backing track, people are going to see you live and they expect that you're a good live band. Like, the majority of people will go to a show and they'll have no idea that their backing track's there. Do you think it's important that bands display the computer on the line, like guitar, singer, computer? Or, you know, like, what happens if it's less? Like, how important is, you know what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, I do. So I think there's a danger in the way that you frame the question of me agreeing with you that the way that you see the world is the way that everybody sees the world. That was actually sort of your premise of your question. And I didn't want to interrupt you to object. Not everybody expects the same things when they go to a live show. And that's actually exactly the character of music communities, is because everybody has a slightly different access point, meaning some people have liked the music for a while, others less so. Some heard it first in Detroit, others didn't. You know, because everybody has generated their own expectations of the style, not everybody at the same show has the same set of expectations of what counts as authentic on the stage.
And you're right. Like, I guess I am kind of a music snob. Like, I try not to be. Well, you shake your head.
Well, I think that's really pejorative, and I don't feel that way. I don't think you should feel that way about yourself. I think that music snob implies that you have mistaken ideas about what you should care about, and I don't hold that position. You should care about what you care about. I think the issue is when we project those expectations on others and aren't aware that we're doing that. It's not that I would judge that either. I think that's a pretty human response. It's just that I think, like, as a people, we don't move forward if we are not aware that that's how we operate in music scenes. I think that, you know, I don't want us to have an artistic culture where the majority of the conversations we have about the stuff that's really at stake for us is judging whether we're right or somebody else is right. I would much rather have a kind of arts ecology where we find all kinds of eccentricity, we find all kinds of differences, and we kind of rejoice in the fact that we live in a culture that can produce that much eccentricity and difference.
So thinking about all that stuff just zoomed me out a little bit, and now I have a little bit of perspective. You know, maybe I shouldn't be so hard on backing tracks or the musicians who use them. They're there for a reason. They can definitely help live shows. And it's not like backing tracks are going away anytime soon. But I still get excited by bands like Haim. I mean, they don't use a backing track, right?
I mean, it would be interesting. Like, we could, you know, we could check on YouTube and see some of their live shows, and we could figure out whether they're actually playing everything or not.
Can we do that right now?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
You know, you want to do it?
Let's do it.
Okay.
The song's called The Wire.
Oh yeah, I think they're actually really playing. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I couldn't detect it. I mean, I only listened to, like, you know, 30 seconds of a song, but yeah, it feels live.
Okay. And yeah. How does that make you feel?
I mean, you know, I still love hearing a live band. I think it's awesome, you know. I do enjoy it a little more, just a little more, when a band's playing the whole thing and they're really doing it.
That piece came from the podcast Pitch and was produced by Alex Kappelman and Whitney Jones. More from Pitch at wordofmouthradio.org. And after a quick break, we'll look at a 5-story building in Germany that is getting most of its power from algae. The future of algae power when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Most of us can grasp the concept of wind or solar power, but what about supplying the power for an entire building using algae? Algae biofuel has made headlines recently as an alternative to fossil fuels for cars and jets. And last year, a five-story building in Hamburg, Germany, was covered with algae-filled panels to test its viability as an energy source for buildings. The results thus far have been fairly impressive, but will algae prove to be a practical way to power our homes? Ben Schiller is a staff writer for Fast Company's Coexist, where we found his article, "This Algae-Powered Building Actually Works." And Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So the title of your article sort of gets, I think, a little to the surprise that we might all feel when we hear about this concept. So I guess the question is, how does an algae-powered building actually work?
So this building is, I should say, it's an apartment building. It has real people living inside. It's not some concept. And the way it works is on two sides, the south side and the west side, it's completely covered in these panels. They're about an inch thick. And throughout the day, these panels, it's kind of this green gunk, is pumped full of CO2, compressed CO2, and also these nutrients. And when the sunlight hits the panels, the algae multiplies and it gives off this heat. And then this heat can be captured by the building systems, and the actual biomass inside the panels can be captured as well and harvested. And that can be sold off for secondary uses like pharmaceutical products and some food products. So the idea is to have a completely enclosed system producing heat and secondary materials at the same time.
And yeah, like you said, it looks kind of funky, almost like a green rectangular lava lamp. You can sort of see it moving up and down, bubbles going up and down. So are we talking about this algae powering literally everything in the building, lights, heat, everything?
No. At the moment, I think it's powering about 50% of the overall energy demand. There's also some solar panels on the roof. And I think there's some kind of CHP gas system as well, which is kind of backing the whole thing up. The people behind this, who are very sophisticated European engineers, are hoping to gradually increase the output of the actual algae system. So I think over time that they might get somewhere near 100% for the overall building.
Now, you mentioned it's a residential building holding actual tenants. What do they think?
I think they're excited to be there. I mean, they get free energy because it's being sponsored. And, it's pretty cool because, when they invite around their, friends, it's obviously an aesthetic and kind of unusual thing to show them. So it's pretty exciting, I think.
Okay, so let's, I guess, just break down maybe the pros and the cons of using algae as a power source. What are the benefits and what maybe would be the drawbacks?
Well, the benefit is, I mean, it's like a lot of, renewable production like solar panels, for instance. Once you've installed the system, there's basically zero marginal cost to every extra sort of unit of energy you produce after that. So that's a tremendous benefit. There's also a benefit in sequestering CO2 because you're pumping CO2 into the system all day. I mean, it's not a huge benefit, but you've got the benefit actually from putting in the CO2 into the system, and also the benefit from the CO2 you're not producing from another source of energy production. So it's kind of double whammy there. And also that I think it's also teaching the public about energy production. It's a very kind of visible energy system out there, and I think it gets people thinking it's educational.
Okay, so what about the drawbacks then? There's got to be some, right?
Well, the drawbacks is that this is a kind of first of its kind, and anything that's first of its kind is bound to be expensive. These are very specialist systems, and it takes a lot of engineering and maintenance and so on. It's not just like turning on a switch in your garage and getting immediate power. So we're talking very high-end buildings, I think, that would have this and some specialist applications. I mean, the guy I was talking to at the engineering company, Arup, was talking about possible applications in data centers, which are obviously extremely energy-hungry buildings, and they get very hot. So there's kind of two possible benefits there. One is that you, offset some of your energy costs, but also these systems are very good at shading because when the sunlight hits the panel, it absorbs the sunlight and takes down the heat. So that's good for very hot buildings like data centers.
So you mentioned data centers. That makes a lot of sense to me. But I have to wonder, in terms of residential use, if they were trying to expand it, do you think people would be able to handle, the sort of experimental look that these panels offer on a large scale? I mean, it's pretty cool, but at the same time, we're talking about green ooze on the side of a building.
Well, exactly. I think you've said it exactly. I think this is probably an acquired taste. It's something that you certain people would like and certain people would just think is the worst. Yeah, I think, as I said, I think it's specialist applications and specialist people that are going to want this.
Well, Ben Schiller, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks very much.
Ben Schiller is a staff writer for Fast Company's Coexist, where we found his article, This Algae-Powered Building Actually Works. And you can find a link to the article where you can see some pictures of the building at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. And right now on Facebook, we're asking listeners their views on a topic we discussed earlier today, back hair. Now, I don't really have this issue as I have virtually no back hair, but I am curious to hear about what you think. Should men wax their backs, or should they let it all hang out? Let us know what you think. After all, the most fascinating conversations, even those ones about back hair, tend to travel via word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.